The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Canada, like the U.S., has been experiencing record numbers of deaths due to a toxic drug supply and drug overdose. The Drug User Liberation Front, along with several other organizations, held a news conference on April 13th to discuss the need for Canada to take a radically different approach toward drugs and toward people who use drugs. Let's hear first from Brian O'Donnell with the British Columbia Association of People on Opiate Maintenance.
Hi, Brian O'Donnell. I'm with the British Columbia Association of People on Opiate Maintenance and also on the Bandu Board. 2,224 people died in British Columbia last year that shouldn't have. It's 26% increase from 2020. We've lost 10,000 in 6 years since the government's considered it an emergency, state of emergency. But what have they done? Absolutely nothing. So Vandu has worked with the Drug User Liberation Front to distribute 17 grams of free clean heroin, cocaine, and crystal methamphetamine to members of the drug user groups all over the province. Like that, we're going to continue to do it until the government listens to us. We urge the government to listen to us and know that this toxic supply has got to stop. Okay? And there's only way we can do it is if we take control like that and start, you know, let the government's got to give us the exemption to be able to have, you know, a compassion, right? So we can stop people dying. This is, they call it a state of emergency and we're just ignoring it. Well, we're doing it ourselves. You know, we're going to, you know, if the government's not going to listen to us, we will do it ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Are you just going to, next up, Dave Hamm.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Hamm. I'm on the executive or on the board of the directors at Bandu. Anyways, policy by government is supposed to be for the people, enhance their life, and give them a modicum of safety. Canadian drug policy has created a death penalty situation where people that use drugs are now on death row, not knowing if they're the next victim of of this bad policy. So in the spring of 2021, a group called Drugs, Dedicated Revolutionaries Urge Good Safe Supply, started a meeting. And it was because the drug supply is always changing and our survival methods have to change too. So we're a peer-led group of users dedicated to building power to change drug policies, including but not limited to real safe supply, which is what we need, a real safe supply. We need a government that's going to step up and look after its population as it is mandated to. The policies are not to put people into a position where they're underneath a death sentence. So I don't know how else to put it. If you don't change it, then you are part of the problem. And we need that changed up.
That was Brian O'Donnell with the British Columbia Association of People on Opiate Maintenance. He was followed by Dave Hamm with the Vancouver Area Network of People Who Use Drugs. Now here's Charlene Burmeister with the BCCDC and the founder and executive director of the Coalition of Substance Users of the North.
Thank you. So my name is Charlene Burmeister. I am the person with Lived and Living Experience Stakeholder Engagement Lead at the BCCDC. I'm also the founder and executive director of the Coalition of Substance Users of the North, or CSUN. CSUN is an alliance of people who use or have used currently illegal drugs. Our members are dedicated to improving the life of all substance users who live in Northern BC and BC and throughout Canada. CSUN was the first drug user organization formed in the Northern region. We since then have a few other drug user groups that have formed, which is really great to see. I think we need to, it was said before, the reality is that we need to see the same urgency that we saw with COVID. There was implementation of, things that made sense, supported people when COVID hit, and it was instantaneous. And we have not had the same privilege as people who use drugs in regards to the value of our lives. I'd also like to see that we have access to regulated supply that's been repeated over and over again. We as Canadians should have the right to access to the substances of our choice in the same fashion in which we do of alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis today. I would like to see this work move away from organized crime settings so that people don't continue to be victims of substance use. I would also like to recognize that we put a lot more money into treatment options than we do into safe supply and regulation and the other pieces that we know are the keys to prevent these what are absolutely preventable deaths. And so we do need treatment for people who want those options, but we need treatment that makes sense for people. When people don't have the supports that they need to go into treatment centers, we're often considered non-compliant, and then there's resistance with any systems that we try to engage with. But I also think we need to realize that as Canadians, there are people who have good relationships with drugs, and human beings have been consuming mind and body altering substances for years, and we will continue to do so. And trying to push people who use drugs into being people who do not use drugs is ineffective and has not worked. And we recognize that the failed war on drugs has really just equated to a war on people who are poor, people who are traumatized, and people who are oppressed. It's failed over and over again, but the reality is we are here 6 years into a crisis with small incremental steps, putting Band-Aids on bullet holes while the numbers continue to rise and people continue to die. I think those are the messages that we're going to hear over and over again, and we've been hearing for 6 years. Every day our phones ring. Who's next? We're afraid to answer our phones. I think the reality is that people with lived and living experience are also on the front lines doing this work, carrying most of the burden that really should be that of the health authorities, and that government should have intervened a long time ago. I'll end on those words and look forward to hearing from the other presenters as well. Thank you.
That was Charlene Burmeister, founder and executive director of the Coalition of the Substance Users of the North, speaking at a news conference April 13th to discuss the need for a radically different approach toward drugs and toward people who use drugs. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Addiction recently held a webinar on women and drugs. Let's hear from a couple of the speakers. Dr. Sarah Morton is the Vice Principal for Teaching and Learning for the College of Social Sciences and Law and Director of the Community Partnership Drugs Program at University College Dublin.
I really thought about from which perspective will we look at this particular topic. And I was thinking too, at a local and a regional and a national level, very often we get caught into a consideration of what women are doing. And I thought what I would much prefer to do is talk to you for kind of 10 minutes around how do we understand that the context and the experiences of women have changed. So rather than what they are doing, how do we understand the context within which they are surviving, thriving, or behaving? So I'm going to look at some of the changes in drug trends and drug markets, because of course they impact on women's substance use trajectories, particularly over the life course. I also wanted to build on what Christina and Christiana had said and look at some of our own emerging understandings and knowledge of women's experiences, and from a very situated practice-based knowledge. And focusing again on what we understand differently perhaps over about women's experience than perhaps we did 10 or 15 years ago. So just moving on to the next slide. I have a few ideas here around drug trends and drug markets, which you will see will link with the previous presentations. So one of the interesting things that Anderson and Kavanaugh talk about is how we need to think about new ways of how gender organizes and is embedded within illicit drug markets, including for them, they highlight the overlap and interplay of legal and illegal drugs in producing drug problems. And this is what we see when we're working with women over the life course, particularly around medication misuse and kind of choice of substances. Novel distribution styles, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a second, and also what the consequences for women are in relation to engaging in drug use. Some of the things that we've seen from a practice perspective is the impact of digitalization of drug sale and supply, medication misuse, and the changes in development in illicit medication supply and use, which particularly impacts on women. We've also seen in different contexts in Europe and beyond the increasing cocaine and crack cocaine supply and use. And finally, another point that I'd add from this kind of situated knowledge is the impacts on all forms of transactional sex, sex working, exchange of sex for drugs, prostitution due to the digitalization and types of substances available and the digitalization both of those both markets. And I suppose the question we're left with, which links back exactly to our first presentation, was do our monitoring systems incorporate a gender view of emerging trends and impacts? So just moving on to the next slide. There's just one kind of, I suppose, two sets of ideas that I wanted to run through around this. Kolar talks around this kind of gendered stigma and normative standards, which again links very much with what Christiana talked about for young women and gendered accessibility. And this urges us to think about the gendered social organization of drug markets and how this impacts on women and their use and patterns, and also how we have conversations with women around this, because of course traditionally how we understand drug markets and how those have been monitored have been from a more patriarchal perspective. And I'll just move on to the next slide. One of the things that I find interesting when thinking about this is Anderson and Kavanagh again look at these kinds of gender relations and the intersectionality of race and class and how that shapes experience and how does that also shape our understanding of drug markets and women's roles and functioning within this. For instance, they highlight that very often women's drug involvement intersects with situations of extreme economic and social disadvantage and other experiences of trauma. And also very often, even if they're in a relationship and a male partner is then incarcerated, that often impacts on women's access to material provisions. And it made me think about if we don't acknowledge the context of women's experience and the structural context of that, how can we basically support any positive change in her life when there's substance misuse issues? But also if those context and structural difficulties remain unchallenged or changed, then how can we also expect women to change? I'm just going to talk very briefly around our kind of knowledge base on the next slide. What I would, I suppose, like to argue at this point is that practice and intervention can serve as some of our main sites of knowledge of women's substance use patterns and trajectories over the life course. Some of the challenges around this is that our knowledge and understanding can remain very local and situational. And that knowledge extrapolation can be really difficult due to both the kind of patriarchal roots of our treatment and intervention systems and the underpinning ideology of treatment and intervention. So very often when we talk about this issue, there's real understanding of what women are experiencing, but we find that difficult to extrapolate into major system change. One example of this would be an action research study that we did a year and a half ago. And when we talked to practitioners and asked them to consider their organizations around substance misuse treatment for women, there was a realization that they often internalized, even in quite subtle ways, the gender roles and expectations within their treatment and interventions and their work with women. So where does that leave us? I'll just move on to the next slide. There's two more themes that I want to touch on before we look at the end at the kind of implications. We've talked about this idea of trauma, and again, ACEs is one that is a particular view of trauma. But what we know around ACEs and women is that sexual experiences of sexual abuse, physical abuse, and exposure to parental domestic violence as a child have independent positive relationships to lifetime drug and alcohol issues. But what we also know is that 90% of women in substance misuse treatment have a history of traumatic violence. So there's evidence of this lifespan victimization and a combination of adverse childhood experiences and trauma in childhood and substance use puts women at further risk for future domestic violence and sexual abuse. So this lifespan aspect is key. And for instance, in one study, it was found that women involved in the criminal justice system linked themselves, their whole trajectory and experiences of substance misuse and later harms to adversity experienced in childhood. So just the next slide has a couple of points around intersectionality. We know that substance use patterns and trajectories are often different from women. And Christina talked already about this idea of telescoping and accelerated progression. And we also know that women's substance use may intersect with these wider social factors. So other factors may also predicate or compound experiences of exclusion, you know, migrant status, disability, poverty, homelessness. So what are the implications for us around this? And I came up with three because I thought this is so complicated, we need a way forward. And these are the three questions that I was left with that I thought it might be useful to think about. How do we design and develop interventions and responses that circumnavigate patriarchal constructs and understandings of drug markets and substance misuse treatment? How do we incorporate the embodied and lived experience of women's substance use across the life course and beyond the lens of pregnancy and motherhood, which is very often how policy and intervention has started to focus or initial focus? And also my final kind of implication was, I feel we really need to consider how we may be internalizing or normalizing these dominance constructs and expectations of women's behavior and life course within our responses and interventions.
That was Dr. Sarah Morton, Vice Principal for Teaching and Learning for the College of Social Sciences and Law and Director of the Community Partnership Drugs Program at University College Dublin. She was part of a panel sponsored by the European Union's Drug Agency, the EMCDDA, entitled Women and Drugs in Europe, Why Gender Matters. Now let's hear from Judy Chang, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs.
So just to start off with, want to also acknowledge that I think, you know, any of us who've worked and researched drug use and harm reduction for any significant amount of time, you know, we know that the more we work on it, the bigger, more complex and more unwieldy the issue becomes. You know, illicit drug use patterns and trends have indeed changed from more traditional drugs such as heroin, cannabis, cocaine, and speed to newer drug trends such as NPS, synthetic cannabinoids, synthetic opioids such as fentanyl and methamphetamine. So we've seen, drugs research has also become more complex, as we've seen from the two excellent presentations today. And as over time, I think we've learned to bring in more of the nuance and more reflection on this complexity. So gender, along with many other intersecting social and structural factors such as class, race and ethnicity, sexual orientation and gender identity, influence patterns of use, but it also influences how we use drugs and what impacts not only drug use, but drug policies have on our experiences of drug use. So I think any serious consideration of gender and other social factors means that we can't just simply accept that drug dependency is easily explained as a disease to be simply cured. Being able to acknowledge this nuance and complexity means we can begin to produce more accurate and nuanced research, which will lead to better policies that are more appropriate and, most importantly, healthy, socially integrated people that aren't disconnected, incarcerated, or literally dying in their hundreds of thousands from preventable deaths. So in my talk, I also wanted to focus, of course, on to center my own lived experience of drug use over life courses, you know, from a gendered perspective. I may not be a young person that uses drugs anymore, but definitely once was. I would probably be defined now in my middle age, but I'm in a position to reflect on my drug using career up till now. And I think drug use, which not many people really consider, is also a search for meaning for the individual in a lot of ways. So like many people, if I look at the start of my drug using career, you know, started from a young age, 13, 14. Of course, these are the teenage years. I'm sure everyone can relate. They're typical ages for experimentation. So the recreational use of cannabis, acid, ecstasy, speed. And I think, you know, during this point as well, most of the experiences were positive, and there's always that element of, you know, seeking pleasure. I would say, yes, about 18, 19, moved to heroin use, developed a habit, so drug dependent. But I think unlike some trends amongst women who inject drugs, also learned to inject myself very quickly, you know, so had that independence. I think, you know, it's not as much as the media says, dependency isn't immediate, developing a habit isn't immediate, but it wasn't done, you know, completely inadvertently either. You know, there's reasons that people and women use drugs. It helps to, you know, numb people. It helps to, you know, regulate emotions and mental state. And I think generally, you know, we accept the stereotype of people who use drugs, and probably particularly of women who use drugs, of this, you know, sense of being out of control, that it always means being out of control of our own bodies and minds. But, you know, that's not the whole truth. I think that, you know, drug use, and many of us who use drugs do use drugs to have some control, some semblance of control over the state of mind and how we respond and react to situations. So it was about 2 years later, so, you know, probably quite early on, that I entered into methadone treatment. And, you know, contrary to people's beliefs also, you know, treatment doesn't always mean you stop taking drugs. Many people continue to use drugs, but it does help to better control and regulate that drug use. And this, you know, this consideration should be and was supposed to be at the heart of harm reduction programs, right? This non-judgment, that it shouldn't be tied to expectations of abstinence or accepting that it's okay to try and punish people who don't stay abstinent. So in considering the role of gender in this use, you know, looking, I think we do need to look at alternative framings as well. And when we apply a feminist lens to it, I think, you know, there's just a different framing and consideration, a kind of widening of meaning for drug use as well. So myself, I come from a migrant family, and, you know, experimentation and drug use is a lot of times a part of rebelling. You know, I was pushing back on what was expected of me, what society, my family told me I should do or be. As the two other speakers have said, you know, we know women who use drugs are judged way more harshly than men. This is because drug use is seen as risk-taking behavior, and drug dependency, you know, is often perceived as selfish, and women are expected to conform to gender norms of good behavior and selflessness. So it's not to say that, you know, personal trauma does not play a role, but I think we do inordinately focus a lot on individualized trauma, and we don't really, you know, weight enough the structural harms of criminalization, drug policies, and gender inequality. So, for instance, because of stigma and discrimination that is very much fueled by drug laws, women who use drugs, including myself, are much more likely to hide our drug use, which means we use alone, and that means we're more likely to overdose. We're more avoidant of harm reduction and healthcare services because of the shame and judgment. And as other speakers have mentioned before, you know, we're more vulnerable to sexual harassment, not only from police, but also from medical personnel and doctors. Because once we're out about our drug use, even if it's, you know, just in front of one doctor, there's this, you know, sense that they can get away with things that they never would in front of other clients. So I think now at my age, middle age, when I, you know, look at my drug use career, I feel that there is more control of my drug use than ever before. I think in a lot of ways that does accord with life stages. You know, people generally find their lives becoming more stable. It's less about experimentation and more about consolidation. But, you know, I also come from a place of privilege, and that, you know, I have found a place and meaning in life. I get to have a job and live a life where I don't have to feel ashamed about drug use. And I think, you know, in some ways that's part of a feminist impulse of not allowing others to make you feel shame for wanting to make your own decisions about your own body and mind. that's not to say, you know, the way society judges that people are immune to this judgment, but I have been fortunate in many ways. So I haven't been incarcerated, but have definitely lived through the fear and harassment. I've never lost a job because of my drug use. I was able to be financially independent, and worked in the sex industry. I've never been a mother who's had to watch their child being taken away, though I know at the same time, you know, a court will most likely never allow me to adopt as an out drug user. I've pretty much always had access to harm reduction or found innovative ways to access it. So I think there are all these unique ways that we found to punish women who use drugs, which the world justifies because of misconceptions and stereotypes. But how the world views women who use drugs, you know, does not match my own experiences nor my worldview of the people and the community that I see around me. So I really do see women who use drugs as being some of the most real, authentic, smart, insightful, funny, empathetic, and incredibly resilient. You know, we survive through a world that truly tries to break you down and wants to make you feel that there is something inherently wrong with you. You know, so much to the point that we imprison women who use drugs and sometimes resort to torture in order to fix people. So the only women who are able to survive this and still retain some semblance of pride and dignity and who refuse to hide and be silent, you know, are the strongest. So looking forwards and, you know, what needs to change. So just, you know, 5 recommendations, not simple, but very important, and we should be looking to progress them. So 1, to be able to change our perceptions and attitudes and counter misinformation on drug use by acknowledging its nuance and complexity. And we need to be sharing narratives that aren't all negative, because there are also positive stories to share. So one example that I would point to is it's called the Narcofeminism Story Share Project. It's run by Urban Survivors Union in the US. So it's basically a storytelling project of women who use drugs. 2, so the need to produce research, particularly qualitative research that captures the complexity of drug use amongst women and make sure women who use drugs are meaningfully involved in this research. 3, to fully decriminalize drug use. You know, as we all know, there are successful country examples in Europe, so there isn't the need to look very far. 4, services need to understand the needs of women who use drugs, and we know that understanding these needs will only come from listening and treating women who use drugs as equal partners. And I do agree with Sarah's presentation as well, that the treatment system is very patriarchal, with, you know, lots of rules and regulations to try and like shape people into, you know, what the system thinks people should be. And 5, last but not least, the critical to fund and politically support women who use drugs led organizations and responses in line with the global AIDS targets that every country in Europe has committed to.
That was Judy Chang, Executive Director of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs. She was part of a panel sponsored by the European Union's Drugs Agency, the EMCDDA, entitled Women and Drugs in Europe, Why Gender Matters. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.